See a woman in her 40s who, since you have known her, has always worn jeans, sandals and sweaters, the dampers that soft-pedal the passing of the years. When you see that same woman wearing a fur coat, you know that her mother has died. So you compose your face as you see her coming towards you, ruling out anticipation, preparing for surprise, and you wait for her to inform you. Hello, Rose, how are you?
Not so good. My mother died last week.
Oh, I'm sorry. Now take your eyes off the coat that screams inheritance. But where can you look that isn't suddenly Persian lamb? Even Rose's hair has caught its black, curly texture. Hence the coat, Rose is saying in apology. It's nice, you say, hypocrite that you are. What's nice about Persian lamb? A bequest fur, exclusively. Who, in their right mind, would buy it pristine off the sheep? Then you notice the diamond earrings, and your eye goes naturally to the fingers, and sure enough, the matching rings are there, too. Poor Rose. She tucks in her ears and her hands, but only into the collar and muff of the lamb. Come back for a coffee, she says, and you know that her familiar bedsitter, lined with books and records, now blushes for the invasion of alien silver and linen. The place is in a bit of a mess, Rose is saying, her key in the door. Rose's place was always in a mess, but she'd never apologized for it before. You didn't apologize for books strewn on the floor, records out of their sleeves, and a desk cluttered with ash, paper and files. It was your own mess, and you had made it, and it spoke of the work and the kind of living of which you were not ashamed. But the mess that Rose was apologizing for was none of her making. It spoke not one syllable of her way of life. It was another's intrusion, another's chaos. There was hardly room to open the door, and you had to go in singly, picking your way over chests of linen, cabinets of silver, the cluttered savings of another's mistaken priorities. What can I do with it all? Rose is saying, but not asking, because you know that she's just stating a problem that she dares not solve. And you, being logical, sensible, and insensitive, say, sell it. And you look at her face, and you see a friendship dying. You cover up, make the coffee, threading your way through the effects to the kitchen. She had a miserable life, Rose is saying, huddled in her mother's lamb. Wouldn't spend a penny on herself, saved, invested. Here it all is. And she did it for me. She was a good mother. This last, in almost a whisper, with too little confidence in its truth to spread it abroad. You were a good daughter, you say, because it seems a natural corollary. Though you know bloody well that Mrs. Feigl was a rotten mother, that nothing Rose ever said or did was quite good enough, that everything merited her constant disapproval, that she had driven her own long-suffering husband to an early grave, and that for the length of her bitter widowhood she had kept Rose by her, in the same bedroom even, and in at 10 every night, or she would want to know why. And who's this new fellow of yours? What's his business? And you haven't got a better dress? And must you always wear the glasses? Until Rose was pushing 30 and looking around and hearing the dull thunder of the years nudging her limbs, in one wild moment of sanity, she filled some carrier bags and, without blessing, left her mother's house. That had been 10 years ago. 10 years since her mother threatened a heart attack. 10 years since that heart attack had refused to oblige, till in the end it was bitterness and a consuming rage that carried her off. The old lady had simply died of anger. And still, from her seething grave, she refused to let Rose go, hanging on by the not-so-thin threat of Persian lamb, shrouding her with the best linen and the blackmail of EPNS. You pour the coffee, and wish to God Rose would take off the coat. But she wraps it round her as if it gives her some sick comfort. Why don't you take it off? You practically shout at her. And diamond earrings look silly during the day. You throw away what's left of your poor discretion because you don't want to see your friend chain herself to what can now only be the future. She fingers the fur as if to annoy you. I wish your mother the best of health, she says, but one day you may be in the same position as I. And that's precisely why you're shouting at her, because you too fear the lamb. May your dear mother live forever. So you make a mental note to ring your mother that evening. After 6 o'clock, the cheap rate time. Not for your own thrift, but for hers, who would take offence at anyone's extravagance on her behalf.
What can I do, Rose is still saying.
You can do one of two things, you say, and hope that when your time comes, please God, not too soon, she, Rose, will be the sensible one.
You can keep it, or you can sell it.
If you keep it, you'll have to find a bigger flat to accommodate it all, and a posher place it'll have to be to live up to it. Or you sell it, and you use the money for the things you've always wanted. Travel, for instance.
Rose shudders at your insulting logic. She never travelled, she's saying. Southend maybe once or twice in her life. She was saving it for me.
Then you lose your cool, and you say, knowing that Rose is the last of the line, you say, and who are you saving it for? But all that succeeds in doing is to remind her of the barrenness of her life, and the tears begin to flow. You get up to comfort her, climbing over the linen chest between you. And the coffee upsets and seeps through the cracks onto the virgin linen inside.
Rose leaps up like a panther and tears the chest open, winces at the trickle of coffee that slithers over the embroidered sheets and tablecloths.
Look what you've done, she whimpers, crouching like a skinflint over his pile.
And you look at her and marvel at how quickly the rot can set in.
I'll go, you say, doing yourself more of a favour than her, for you want to get out of there, back to your own furless, linenless dwelling, and you pray to God that whatever the price, your own mother will live for ever. You're back in your own bedsitter, and you're dialing furiously, to hell with the cheap rate, and your heart is beating while she doesn't answer, and you pray she's there and well. And when at last you hear her martyred and long-suffering, hello, you're not surprised at the overwhelming love that invades you.
Mama! Oh, my God, what's the matter?
Nothing, Mama, nothing at all. Just phoning to say hello.
At this time of day? So much money you have?
And at the sound of her familiar disapproval, you feel at peace and back in battle, and you thank God that she lives to irritate you so.
I just felt like talking to you. I thought a husband at least you've found, she's saying. Only for such a reason should you behave like a Rothschild.
But how are you, you insist.
I'm not complaining.
She's saying, complaining all the time.
Though if I saw you settle down in my lifetime, believe you me, I shouldn't have such aggravation.
How's your back, you say, easing her into specifics?
Not so good, but I'm not complaining.
And you know she's not complaining, because in the middle of the day, at 20 pence a minute, it's cheaper to be well and without detail.
You should go on a holiday, you say. Go to America to see the family.
Holidays, she sneers.
Who can afford holidays?
And you can see the solid Georgian silver shrieking behind her in the cabinet, and you know it could take her round the world a dozen times.
You're still going to Paris? She asks joylessly.
I have to go to a teacher's conference, you say, not daring to suggest for one moment that you might be going for pleasure.
All right, so when you come back, perhaps I'll go to America, she says,
as if one of you has to stay at home to look after England. Look after yourself, Mama, you say.
Who else should look after me?
But you pass that one over and tell her you'll ring her later in the week. And she tells you to do it after 6 o'clock, for nothing is that important, living or dying, that cannot wait to be told till the cut price hour.
I love you, Mama, you hear yourself saying.
And you hear her silence and know she is smiling.
You're a good daughter to me.
And you're a good mother, you mouth. And as you put the phone down, you pray to God that whatever the price, your mother's senility, her irritations, her possessiveness, her stubbornness, her pride, whatever it costs, please God, do what you will with me, but save me from the lamb.
You let a few days pass before you call on Rose again.
And when you do, it takes her some time to open all the locks on the door. There was a time, you remember, when Rose's door was always open and casual coffee drinkers dropped in and out. Now the hassle of opening up the place as if it were some museum precluded the casual visitor, and even you begin to doubt whether you'll call again. You feel suddenly as if you've come to the wrong place. And when you enter the living room, you look for traces of your friend. Where are the records and the books? Even the desk and the papers that throb through the ears of Rose. Quiet now. The pulse gone from the room, stilled by the bird's-eye maple table and its linen cloth. Numbed by the cabinet of silver, wholly anaesthetized by inheritance.
Where are your books, you say?
I sold them.
Where do you do your work? Where's the desk?
Giving it up, she says. I have enough to live on, thanks to my dear mother. God rest her soul.
What's this, you ask yourself? This dear mother bit, this God rest her soul. Where did she pick up this middle-aged, obsequious phraseology? She, who only a while ago was in monosyllabic and fearless jeans. And you have to face the truth that when Rose's mother died, it was Rose who, by her own and helpless choice, was buried. Shall I make coffee, you say, more for old time's sake? But no, sit down. Rose will make it, like any good hostess. But now it takes hours to prepare, with respect to the crown derby and the side plates and embroidered serviettes, for God's sake, and Rose with her manicured little finger curled round the bone china handle. And you long to go back to your cheap mugs and the freedom of your comparative poverty. How's your mother, Rose is saying. And you know that her question has nothing to do with concern. Immortal, you say viciously. You get up to go. Suddenly, you can't bear the lace doily and all the monogrammed paraphernalia that has nothing to do with your old and loved friend. And you scream to yourself, I'm not an orphan yet. I cannot live like this. Rose sees you out coldly with much locking of doors behind. And you know that she resents you because you are still a daughter. Small comfort in that, for you know too, and with an absolute and trembling certainty, that sooner or later, when the lamb comes to colonize you, Rose will be your friend again.